Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire, 1000 B.C., when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's more than 286,000 cubic miles of water pour into the oceans every year. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and yet the sea has not increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the circle or cycle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then to ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Well, in modern science, meteorology understands and comprehends how this process works. Modern science has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago, and that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School. For more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the book written by Stephen Collins called The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, a book on a secular history, the origins of the ancient nation of Israel combined with the city-states of Tyre and Sidon, commonly known as Phoenicia. Well, King David, up until the last program, had conquered the land from Egypt to east of the Tigris-Euphrates River. The Israelite Empire stretched from the Nile River to the Euphrates River and probably included Arabia and Turkey, certainly as far north as Aramea or Armenia today. Now, at the conclusion of Israel's momentous victory over the combined powers of Ammon, Syria, Assyria, and other allied nations, King David was in a position of hegemony over the ancient Middle Eastern world, and Israel's military supremacy on land was united with Phoenicia's maritime supremacy, and David was at the height of his glory. No nation had the power to challenge him. His attention now turned to his personal pet project, and that was the building of a grand temple to honor the God of Israel. Now, while God did not allow David to actually build the temple, as we see in 2 Samuel 7, verses 1 through 13, he was allowed to make preparation for its construction under his son Solomon. These preparations were David's primary project for the remainder of his reign. with vast war booty and tribute payments pouring in from vassal nations and access to raw materials throughout the world by way of the maritime routes and maritime fleets of his Phoenician allies. King David amassed everything imaginable for the temple of God. Just how widespread these Phoenician contacts were, we will now investigate. David's prodigious temple preparations and his instructions to Solomon to implement the construction are recorded in 1 Chronicles 22, verses 1 through 16. David accumulated vast stores of iron for nails and clamps, showing that ancient civilizations were fully familiar with the use of iron ore and iron and steel by the beginning of the first millennium B.C., and he also accumulated bronze in quantities beyond weighing. Some Bibles state that brass rather than bronze was stockpiled in unaccountable amounts. Brass and bronze are different alloys of copper, but it is clear that David accumulated massive stockpiles of copper, copper ores, and refined copper products for Solomon to utilize in his reign. He also amassed much cedar wood through his alliance with the city-states of Tyre and Sidon, and in the course of his wars, David had collected large amounts of gold and silver from tributary nations, and verse 14 quotes David as summing up his temple preparations with these words. Quote, "With great pains I have provided for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold, and 1,000,000 talents of silver, and bronze and iron beyond weighing, and there is so much of it, timber and stone too, have I provided." Unquote. Now the total of 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver was the amount dedicated just for the temple itself. One can only imagine how much gold and silver were available in the national treasury after David's many successful wars. Disagreement exists concerning the weight of the talent at David's time, but by any definition of a talent, the amount of gold and silver dedicated by David for temple use represents an immense amount of wealth. And in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 2, it also adds that David accumulated wood, onyx, and all manner of precious stones and marble stones in abundance for use in the temple project. Now, I don't know what the author's definition of a talent is, but from what I've heard, it's 130 pounds. So if you take 130 times 100,000, and that's 130 times 100,000, that equals 13 million pounds of gold. Now, if we take the 13 million pounds and we divide that by a standard ton, that is divided by 2,000, we would come up with 6,500 tons of gold. Now, that's as much gold as you'll find in a small ship. 6,500 tons. Now, if we divided the 6,500 tons... I mean, if you multiplied that out, converted it to ounces, and converted that to dollars, I mean, you're talking about many billions of dollars worth of gold going into that temple. Now, an obvious question needs to be asked. Where did King David get such a stockpile of metal ores that it was beyond weighing? Since David's workmen did weigh the gold and silver stockpiles, the latter being 1,000,000 talents. The copper and iron stockpiles obviously had to far exceed the precious metal stockpiles to be considered beyond weighing. So let's just take a look at 1,000,000 ounces, or what was that, 1,000,000 talents, 1,000,000 talents. Well, it'd be 130 times 1,000,000, so that's 130 million pounds. So let me just take 130. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and divide that by 2,000. about 65,000 tons. Now, that's about 1.5 times the weight of the Titanic or the Queen Mary. 65,000. Now, that's assuming that the talent weighs 130 pounds, which is the number that I got. And, of course, that's why the author said, well, it depends upon what you call a talent. Now, the vast amounts of gold and silver were imported from elsewhere as a result of war booty, tribute payments, and foreign trade. The entire Israelite nation was wealthy during King David's reign. And in 1 Chronicles 29, verses 1 through 9, it records that David's own subjects donated immense amounts of gold, silver, brass, and iron. Verse 7 states that the people gave 18,000 talents of brass, 100,000 talents of iron, and it's interesting that they gave many times more iron products than copper products, and this indicates that iron products were more commonplace than copper-based products as ancient Israel, or in ancient Israel, around 1000 B.C. Now, oftentimes we hear talk about the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and they always picture, you know, modern historians always picture, and anthropologists show us a man with his knuckles dragging on the ground. The truth of the matter was, mankind at 1000 B.C. was far advanced technologically compared to what we believe he was at that time. Far beyond what we imagine today. As we'll see as we progress along in Solomon's reign. Now, surely an incalculable stockpile of copper and iron ores and products could not have come from sources indigenous to Palestine or the Middle East. Since David was closely allied with the Phoenician city-states, he could import anything he wanted, and he could import it from anywhere that the Phoenician trading ship sailed. Now, it is well documented that the Phoenician trading ships dominated the commerce of the Mediterranean Sea, and that they sailed into the Atlantic Ocean to reach ports in Western Africa and northwestern Europe. Now, the question arises, how far did these Phoenician fleets sail? Well, a prominent historian, George Rawlinson, affirms that the Phoenicians had commercial and colonial settlements throughout the Mediterranean region, such as in Greece, Egypt, Asia Minor, Italy, North Africa, Spain, as well as the Atlantic coasts of modern Spain and France and into the British Isles. And he also comments on the importance of mining and trading metal ores in the Phoenicians' commercial relations in the following words. Here's Rawlinson. He said, quote, Phoenician ships crossed the English Channel to the Scilly Islands and conveyed thither a body of colonists. The attraction which drew them was the mineral wealth of the islands and of the neighboring Cornish coast on the island of Britain. It is reasonable to suppose that the Phoenicians both worked the mines and smelted the ores, and they certainly drew from this quarter those copious supplies of tin and lead which they imported into Greece and Asia. Unquote. George Rawlinson. Now, it is known that an important part of the Phoenicians' commercial traffic consisted of metal ores and refined metal products. Since they had mining and smelting facilities in the British Isles, they had to have a permanent colony located there. The Phoenicians' trade in metals involved long-distance sailing, and Rawlinson indicated that the Phoenicians mined and smelted ores in the British Isles and transmitted or transported those metal ores and products to Greece and Asia. Therefore, it is obvious that the Phoenician fleets could have transported metal ores from locations in the Atlantic region, the British Isles, to the ancient kingdom of Israel to satisfy King David's voracious appetite for metal ores for the temple of God. Now, another writer, Thomas Johnston. Johnston asserts that the Phoenicians even designed their vessels to accommodate large quantities of metal ores. And he writes, it is necessary that we should not lose sight of the increasing range of these voyages. For in this will be found a sufficient cause for the increasing tonnage of the Phoenician ships. The size of the vessels of the Phoenicians would not depend on the relatively small cargo of a manufactured nature consigned on the outward voyage, so much as on their carrying capacity for the bulky raw material which formed the staple of the return cargoes. Insufficient attention has been given to this aspect of the advanced state of the Phoenician merchant marine during the period of Hiram and Solomon. Unquote. Now, significantly, it is recorded that the Phoenicians increased the range of their voyages and the size of their vessels during the reigns of Hiram and Solomon. King Hiram's reign included the reign of King David, and David's incredible need for raw materials for the temple of God and eventually King Solomon's expansive building projects required that the Phoenicians build larger vessels to satisfy this need. The tin trade between the British Isles and Mediterranean customers was very important to the Phoenicians. And Johnston also writes, quote, that there was one branch of their distant sea trade to which the Phoenicians clung with extreme tenacity. They prevented even the Romans from sharing that with them. This was the tin trade with Cornwall, which was one of the chief sources of their wealth, tin being required for hardening into bronze and copper, which they used for tools. Now, the 13th century historian Sir William Betham cites Caesar's written records about the prominence of the metals trade in the British Isles. Here's what he wrote. Quote, Caesar says the Britons had mines of silver, iron, tin, and lead, but they imported brass. This confirms that the British Isles were significant in the metals trade throughout the first millennium B.C. The Phoenicians developed the British mining trade, and their colony in Carthage continued this trade during most of the rest of the first millennium B.C. Now, the trade in metal ores and products was a vital part of the Phoenicians' maritime traffic. Many historians have noted that the Phoenicians and their Carthaginian offspring prevented the Greeks and the Romans from accessing the lands of the Atlantic Ocean. They did this to keep a monopoly on the products that they imported from the Atlantic region to their Mediterranean customers. Because King David's Israel was part of the Phoenician alliance, the Phoenician metal imports business was at David's disposal. Indeed, it is likely that David's and Solomon's needs for immense amounts of metal ores was the impetus for the Phoenicians designing vessels big enough to accommodate their needs and demands. Many readers are familiar with the popular biblical resource book named Strong's Concordance. Well, James Strong, whose name is on that concordance, cooperated with John McClintock in authoring the exhaustive Cyclopedia of Biblical, Theological, and Ecclesiastical Literature. That is, concerning the Phoenicians' trade routes, McClintock and Strong tell us the following. Quote, the combined fleet of the Israelites and Phoenicians sailed to Ophir, perhaps situated at the mouth of the Indus River in India. It seems that the Indian coasts in general were also called Ophir on the southern coast of Thrace, modern northeast Greece and Bulgaria. The Phoenicians had gold mines, and even on the southern shores of the Black Sea, now northern Turkey, they had factories. The Phoenicians exported tin from the British Isles and amber from the coasts of Prussia. Strabo says that the Phoenicians possessed the best parts of Iberia, that's modern-day Spain and Portugal, before the days of Homer. Unquote. Thomas Johnston asserts that the Phoenicians also traded with the people of ancient Norway. The Phoenicians had extensive traffic in the British Isles and ports of call in the Baltic Sea for the amber trade, so their fleets could easily link Norway and Scandinavia to their maritime empire as well. Phoenicians, sailing into the Baltic Sea, had the coasts of ancient Norway and Sweden on the port side of their vessels, even as the shores of ancient Denmark and Germany were off their starboard sides. In detailing the many materials that King David stockpiled for the temple of God, in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 2, records that he assembled marble stones in abundance. Now, a map from the book, The Milestones of History, Ancient Empires, indicates that the Phoenicians imported marble from the island of Paros in the Aegean Sea, copper from Cyprus, iron from the Caucasus region of the Black Sea. And secular and biblical history are completely congruent with each other in the time of King David's alliance with the Phoenicians. Secular historical sources confirm that King David had access to all of the materials listed in the Bible, which he amassed for the temple project, and all of the materials and commodities listed in the Bible as being stockpiled by King David were readily available by way of the merchant fleets of King David's close allies, the Phoenicians. Clearly, then, the Phoenicians had the most expansive and far-flung commercial empire in the history of the ancient world. Phoenicia's colonists and trading fleets explored and linked a larger portion of the globe than the empires of Julius Caesar and of Alexander the Great combined. And while Rome and Greece sought to conquer as many people as they could, Phoenicia was a capitalist empire that became immensely rich by linking all of the ancient world into an early global economy. However, where the indomitable Phoenicians limited only to the old world in their maritime empire, or were they limited to the old world? And the answer to that question is no, not at all. So let us now examine historical evidence of particular interest to North American readers. A book called The Bronze Age of America by the late Dr. Barry Fell, professor emeritus of Harvard University, documents that copper trading between North America and the Old World existed prior to and during the reigns of King David and Hiram, the king of Phoenicia, the city-states of Tyre and Sidon. And this book cites evidence from ancient inscriptions that Norse kings carried on a copper trade with the St. Lawrence River area in North America as early as 1700 BC, many centuries prior to the reign of King David over Israel. Citing inscriptions cut in the ancient Tifnag and Ogham Khansane alphabets using an early form of the Norse language, found in Ontario, Canada, Dr. Fell concluded that there were old Norse traders in the St. Lawrence River region long before the nation of Israel ever existed. Tifnag and Ogham are both Old World alphabets. If ancient Norse civilizations traded with the inhabitants of North America, could the mercantile Phoenicians have been very far behind? Dr. Fell further documented the existence of ancient Phoenician inscriptions at a site known as Mystery Hill and America's Stonehenge near North Salem, New Hampshire. He observed that carbon analysis point to periods of occupation of the Mystery Hill site extending back to the second millennium BC, and one of the chambers at Mystery Hill was dedicated to the Phoenician god Baal. And ancient inscriptions at this site indicate that it was inhabited or visited by ancient Celts, Iberians and Phoenicians from the Old World over many centuries. Now, additional information about this site and other Phoenician inscriptions in the New World will be more extensively addressed later in this book series. In this present context of King David's massive accumulation of metal ores for the Jerusalem Temple project, it is clearly evident that the Old World traded with the New World in the American-Canadian Great Lakes region during and long before the reign of King David. And it is also evident that the Phoenicians were present in ancient North America during the time of King David. And there is evidence that some of David's copper ore stockpiles came from the Phoenicians and their North American trading routes. The following is from Dr. Fell's book, Bronze Age America. Quote, "There are also reasons for thinking that ancient European voyagers came to America, and they concern the mining of metals. For the past 20 years, leading mining engineers and university metallurgists have been seeking from archaeologists an explanation of the most baffling mystery in the history of mining technology. So far, no answer has been found. But around the northern shore of Lake Superior in Canada and on the adjacent Isle Royal, there are approximately 5,000 ancient copper mine workings. In 1953 and 1956, Professor Roy Dreyer led two Michigan mining and technology expeditions to these sites. Charcoal found at the bases of the ancient mining pits yielded radiocarbon dates indicating that the mines had been operated between 2 and 1000 BC, and the most conservative estimates by mining engineers show that at least 500 million pounds of metallic copper were removed over that time span, and that there is no evidence as to whatever became of 500 million pounds of copper from these sites. Now, the date of 1000 BC is very significant because it was during King David's reign. And the Encyclopedia Britannica states concerning King David's reign that it used to be reckoned from 1055 to 1015 BC, but is now generally fixed at about 1010 to 970 BC. Harper's Bible Dictionary also cites David's reign as being from 1010 to 970 BC. Since the date 1000 BC coincides with David's reign over Israel, it is very likely that Lake Superior copper was used to satisfy King David's voracious appetite for raw materials to be dedicated for temple purposes. And around 1000 BC, King David and Israel were the biggest customers in the world for copper and many other raw materials, of which Solomon's building projects eventually went far beyond anything that even David had envisioned. So the demand upon available world sources of raw materials in their reigns must have been immense, and it is noteworthy that radiocarbon dating indicates that these ancient Lake Superior copper mines were apparently worked to exhaustion around 1000 BC. And that's precisely the time when King David was stockpiling copper ores beyond calculation for the construction of the temple of God in Jerusalem. Now, since the North American copper mines were known to the Old World long before King David ever lived, and two, the Phoenicians were heavily involved in the ancient world's metals trade, there is evidence that Phoenician ships called at ancient North American ports, and the means of transport, or to transport Lake Superior copper ores to King David of Israel, did in fact exist. Now consider Dr. Fell's comments about the ancient North American copper mines. Quote, "Archaeologists have maintained that there was no Bronze Age in North or Northern America, and that no contacts with the outside world occurred. On the other hand, the mineralogists find themselves obliged to take a different view. It is impossible, they argue, for so large a quantity of metal to have vanished through wear and tear, since no large numbers of copper artifacts have been recovered from American archaeological sites, they have erroneously concluded that the missing metal may have been shipped. But shipped where? Could it have been shipped overseas? Now, the mineralogists Dr. Fell refers to are correct. The mystery of what happened to the copper ores mined in the Lake Superior region has, in fact, now been solved. It was used in the Old World, and the Phoenician fleets transported it to the Mediterranean European customers, and indeed access to metal mines from the Atlantic region was long a Phoenician monopoly, which they guarded jealously and carefully. The Bible records that ancient Israel under King David was massively stockpiling copper ores around 1000 BC. Secular sources confirm the North American copper mines were worked to exhaustion, and they were worked out around 1000 BC. Now, the connection should be very obvious. Ancient North American copper was shipped to ancient Israel and used in the construction of the Temple of God in Jerusalem. King David would have received preferential allocation of whatever was being shipped in the vessels of his close Phoenician allies. Now, that's quite a little story. That's a little more than the milk or pablum that we get from archaeology today. Hang on. I'm going to give you a message, and we'll be right back with more. On the story of Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire, about 1000 BC. From the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, by Stephen Collins, when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events, 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or the publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. That's because most of the authors and the publications that we cite on this program are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417 573-4967. Now, if you'd like a copy of this book, it's called The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, written by Stephen Collins. I'm going to give you his number. I do that because this book is so unique. In fact, this series of books are so unique. There's nothing like them. There's nothing that I have ever seen in my life to compare with what this guy has written. There have been books written about Israel and about Jews and Judah, and there's just no end to books written. Solomon made that observation that of the writing of books there is no end. These books are what I term 1 in 100. You'll read 100 books before you find one like it. I have two categories. I have a 1 in 20 series. You can read 20 books before you'll find one like this, or you can read 100. All of these books are 1 in 100. Collins' phone number is 605-361-5069. The reason I'm giving his number out is because he'll endorse these books for you. If you'd like to have a set of these books endorsed, why don't you call him now? He gave them to me for $100. I'm sure he'll give them to you for $100. Now, there's 5 books in the series. He's working on number 6. He told me when I talked to him, number 6 was about the pre-flood world. If it's anything like these 5 books that he's written so far, it's dynamite. And again, nothing like it that I've ever seen. So, the name is Stephen M. Collins, the number 605-361-5069. The book that we're reviewing, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, it's Israel's Rise to Greatness. It's the first British and American empire. And he'll tie the secular and biblical stories together, and you'll see that what we're talking about here is ancient America and ancient Great Britain. Ephraim and Manasseh leading the tribes of Israel in world empire. Remember the British Empire of the 19th century? The sun never set on the British Empire. Well, now the American Empire is worldwide in its scope. And as long as we obeyed God and kept His commandments, we became the wealthiest, most powerful nations in the world. And today, we're on the slippery slope headed toward oblivion. We peaked in our economic, military, and political influence about 1950. And for America, it's been downhill ever since. America and Britain have gone off into evolutionary philosophy and Baal worship. We're now worshiping the sun. And as happened to our ancient forefathers, our nations are going into national captivity. World oblivion is about to overtake us. But there was a grand era to both ancient Israel and modern Israel. So let's go on with the story. Corroborating evidence of this ancient copper trade between the old and the new worlds is contained in a book by Betty Sodders called Michigan Prehistory Mysteries. Her book provides considerable documentation about the extensive copper trade between Michigan's ancient mines and old world cultures. Here's what she writes. Quote, "History relates that about the year 1000 BC, during the height of the Phoenician Empire, copper was used perhaps more extensively than during any other time frame of history. The Phoenicians were well-known merchants with excellent fleets of ships. Perhaps we have underestimated the achievements of Bronze Age people. It appears entire flotillas of Norse, Baltic, and Celtic ships crossed the Atlantic for rich mineral deposits. Here in the New World, they left behind a lasting legacy containing rock inscriptions and drawings in both Iberian and Celtic script." Now, if you'd like a couple of resource leads on that, In Plain Sight by Gloria Farley and America BC by Barry Fell are a couple of books to pick up on that subject. Sauter's book laments the fact that many of the archaeological remains of this ancient copper trade in Upper Michigan were needlessly scrapped or destroyed by souvenir and artifact hunters, as well as by well-meaning early Christians who wanted to destroy what they thought were ancient pagan structures. And Sauter's also notes how extensively the Great Lakes copper mines were exploited. She goes on to say, quote, "These members of long-vanished races had mined every productive copper-bearing vein in this region, from Isle Royale, some 50 miles distant in Lake Superior, to the copper ridges of the Kinawenaw Peninsula, even hidden copper veins that did not directly surface as mineral outcroppings were previously tapped by these people from the past." And Sauter's documents that the University of Michigan and Michigan State University dated some ancient artifacts of the ancient American copper mining culture to 1000 BC, the time of both Kings David and Solomon, these ancient copper miners even constructed elaborate stone circles for use as calendar observatories. Now, given the fact that the Great Lakes climate would turn too hostile to support mining operations in the winter, it was vital to have calendar observatories to discern when to shut down operations and make the final shipments of copper ore to any given shipping season. Inscribed stones with Old World inscriptions have been found in at least 20 American states, from Arizona to Maine, from North Dakota to Georgia. Sauter's comments on the widespread evidence of Old World colonization and Old World civilizations in ancient America in the following words. She said, "All of the major rivers and tributaries, as well as shorelines across the United States, have turned up evidence of a long-gone seagoing race of people. They have left behind evidence and remainders of long-past activity, a legacy comprised of a variety of stoneworks, includes dolmens, stone cairns, cist chambers, inscribed rocks, giant rambling rock walls, and prehistoric copper mining pits. Additional evidence of the copper trade in ancient North America has been unearthed," Sauter's continues. Quote, "In the year 1540, explorer Hernando de Soto discovered mounds in Georgia and South Carolina that contained copper axes, maces, and battle axes, and furthermore, mounds excavated near Cincinnati, opened in 1815, revealed sheets of copper plus two copper plates and several very elaborate copper breastplates worked in complex designs." Unquote. Now, these ancient copper tools and weapons were fashioned by sophisticated Old World cultures and had been buried long before the Spaniards arrived in the Americas. Ancient America was an integral part of an ancient global trading network that was linked together during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon of Israel with King Hiram of Phoenicia, and by the extensive fleets of the Phoenicians. Now, the evidence of this ancient trading network's presence in ancient America does exist, but is rarely, if ever, discussed, especially in establishment history textbooks. So the truth that ancient America's mineral resources were being tapped by Old World civilizations 2.5 millennia before Columbus is ignored, or it is suppressed because it runs counter to conventional theory. However, the truth cannot be suppressed or ignored forever. And this series of books on Israelite history will make increasingly apparent the true role of North and South America in the history of the ancient world. Now there's a smoking gun. A smoking gun piece of evidence has been found showing that ancient Israel was a major user of copper ores at the time, and the ancient copper mines in Michigan were being exploited. Such evidence is found in the remains of smelting facilities that have been uncovered at Ezion Gibur in southern Palestine, described as, quote, the biggest smelting installations in the ancient Middle East, consisting of regular ultra-modern furnaces with a system of air channels, chimney flues, and openings for specific purposes. Warner Keller's book, The Bible is History, dates ancient Israel's smelting facility to the reign of King Solomon after 1000 BC, and he further comments, quote, that the remains of an extensive settlement were excavated, and the most interesting things were casting molds in a vast quantity of copper slag. The site shows an extensive building came into view, and the green discoloration on the walls left no doubt as to the purpose of the building. It was a blast furnace. The mud brick walls had two rows of openings. They were flues. A skillful system of air passages was included in the construction. Now, the whole thing was a proper, up-to-date blast furnace built in accordance with a principle that celebrated its resurrection in modern industry about a century ago, as the Bessemer system, as it is known today. Flues and chimneys both lay along a north-to-south axis, and for the incessant winds and storms from the Wadi El Aruba, had to take over the role of the bellows. Nowhere else in the Fertile Crescent, neither in Babylonia or Egypt, was such a great furnace to be found. Ezion Gibur was the Pittsburgh of old Palestine. Unquote. Now, the copper mines of Lake Superior were exhausted around 1000 BC, and its ores were shipped outside the New World. King David's Phoenician allies had a monopoly on metal ores being shipped from the Atlantic Ocean region to the New World. And ancient Israel had the biggest blast furnace in the Old World for refining copper ores, especially at that time. The conclusion that the Lake Superior copper ores were shipped to ancient Israel by Phoenician fleets and then refined at ancient Israel's Ezion Gibur blast furnace is well supported. And while Solomon, whose building projects dwarfed those of David, surely utilized this blast furnace complex to a greater extent than David ever did, the reign of David lasted until 970 BC, and this blast furnace was likely begun in the reign of King David to smelt and process iron and copper ores into instruments for the temple of God located in Jerusalem. The symmetry between biblical records and secular discoveries is profound, conveying great credibility on the Bible's accuracy and the historicity of the story that we are uncovering. Now, due to ancient Israel's mastery of the Bessemer blast furnace system, it was one of the most industrial advanced civilizations of the ancient world, and most people have mistakenly assumed that ancient Israel was a weak agrarian kingdom. While it was a key agricultural power, it was not or has not been generally realized that under Kings David and Solomon, that it was also the most advanced industrial power of its day. Now the kingdom of Israel under Kings David and Solomon was a true ancient superpower. Consider Israel's national strengths during the later years of King David's reign. Israel was self-sufficient in food production, and it was a major food exporter. One of the things that has made America such a dramatic or dynamic industrial and world superpower is our self-sufficiency in food production. Their huge army had defeated the Assyrian Empire and the powers of Mesopotamia, as claimed in the Bible, and attested to by secular historical records. Israel was closely allied to the world's mightiest naval and maritime power, the Phoenicians. Phoenicia controlled the maritime trade routes, and Israel controlled the important surface commerce routes between Africa, Asia, and Europe. And this intersected in the Middle East. Their possession of the largest smelting facility of that time confirms their commercial and military dominance of the world. And with the largest ore smelting capacity, they could make more trade goods and more weaponry than anybody else on the planet. And near the end of David's reign, his sons contested for the right to succeed David as king of Israel. And the nation's leadership and the nation's armed forces were divided on the issue. In fact, Solomon was crowned king even as his half-brother Adonijah was plotting to have himself crowned king with the cooperation of Joab, Israel's army commander, and Abiathar the priest. Nathan the prophet, Zadok the priest, and Benaiah, the commander of David's bodyguards, remained loyal to Solomon. When Solomon came to power, he executed Adonijah and Joab and banished Abiathar from the priesthood. You read that in 1 Kings 2, verses 13 through 34. David died soon after Solomon's coronation, and a significant comment is found in 1 Kings 1, verse 35, where the dying King David said to Solomon, "I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and over Judah." This comment indicates that even though the United Tribes of Israel rose to national greatness under King David, Israel, that is the northern 10 tribes, and Judah, and the tribe of Benjamin in the south, were still regarded as separate entities, even under the reign of King David, separate entities that temporarily recognized the same king. This comment reveals that the union of Israel and Judah was tenuous, held together only by their loyalty to Kings David and Solomon and their obedience to God's laws. This cohesion of Israel and Judah ended soon after their kings ceased to obey God and the laws of God. And there is a clear lesson for all of the nations, ancient and modern, in the history of Israel and Judah. While national greatness is a direct result of obedience to God and to His laws, national decline results from disobedience to God. The decline may be gradual, but it is also inexorable. So let us now return to the transition from the rule of King David to the rule of King Solomon. As Solomon became king, other nations saw David's son executing his own half-brother and his father's army commander in his first initial acts. These acts gave other nations reason to believe that Solomon was going to be just like his militaristic father. And while other nations likely anticipated that Solomon would try to make a name for himself through conquest as his father had, Solomon became a builder and a scientist instead. However, it did not hurt the security of Solomon's position that he came to power robed in David's bloody mantle and David's feared reputation. This brings to an end the 40-year rule of King David. We read that in 1 Kings 2, verse 11. Now, David united Israel into a cohesive unit, and with God's favor, transformed it into an ancient superpower. So this chapter establishes the foundation for the rest of the information presented in this series of books about Israelite prehistory. It clearly shows that the ancient Israelites were not an obscure people, a bunch of Bedouins traveling around herding their goats and flocks in the desert in some ancient world in the minds of archaeologists. At the time of David's death, they were the dominant power over the entire earth, with huge military resources, lordship over many vassal nations, and advanced industrial technology, and with the Phoenicians' control of the world's land and maritime trade routes. And these facts had to be established early in this narrative to affirm that the Bible's accounts about the Israelites describe the interactions of the great powers of the ancient world, not merely insignificant events that impacted only a few people in ancient Palestine, like David and Goliath. So we will next examine the truly spectacular reign of King Solomon and learn more about the real nature and scope of the Phoenician Empire under Solomon's reign. That's next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, this series of books, and I say series, there are five books in the series. The book I am reviewing now, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. I've got The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History, and Israel's Lost Empires, all by Stephen M. Collins. There's a series of five books that you can have for about $100. Now, I'm not going to sit here and quote somebody else's product or price. I bought these five books from Collins. He autographed the books, and I'm recommending them very highly to all of my listeners. The guy's name, Stephen M. Collins, is number 605-361-5069. He lives up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So I guess the question arises, can anything good come out of South Dakota? Well, the answer is yes, and an emphatic yes at that. You can also order the books, or a book, or one book at a time if you prefer, from the publisher. That's BibleBlessings.net. That's their webpage, BibleBlessings.net. Their address is P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. That's BibleBlessings. Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. It's Israel's Rise to Greatness, the First British and American Empire, 1000 B.C. We became great when we obeyed God and kept His commandments. When we turned to Baal worship, we lost our empire and went into obscurity. We came out of obscurity about 1803 with the purchase of Louisiana Territory. We became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world, militarily, economically, and politically, and until 1950, unchallenged by anybody in the world. And again, we turn to Baal worship. We now practice sun worship as a national pastime. It's our national religion. And about 1950, we began to go the way of ancient Israel. Hey, I'm out of time. I've got to leave it right there. Remember, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember that The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. 7 days a week. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thank you for listening, and until next time, good night, friends.